Eddie in Boston is regarded as less a gift than a sort of cosmic loan. You can't pay the loan back, but you can pay it forward.
By spreading the message that despite all appearances, AA works, spreading this message to the next new guy who's tottered in to a meeting and is sitting in the back row, unable to hold his cup of coffee.
The only way to hang on to sobriety is to give it away. And even just 24 hours of sobriety is worth doing anything for. A sober day being nothing short of a daily miracle, if you've got the disease, like he's got the disease, says the Advanced Basics member, who's chairing this evening's commitment, saying just a couple public words to the hall before he opens the meeting and retires to a stool next to the podium and calls his group's speakers by random lot. The chairperson says he didn't used to be able to go 24 lousy minutes without a nip before he came in. Coming in means admitting that your personal ass is kicked and tottering into Boston AA, ready to go to any lengths to stop the shitstorm. The Advanced Basics chairperson looks like a perfect cross between pictures of Dick Cavett and Truman Capote.
133.
Except this guy's also like totally, almost flamboyantly, bald. And to top it off, he's wearing a bright black country western shirt with Baroque curlicues, a white notey piping across the chest and shoulders, and a string tie, plus sharp-toed boots of some sort of weirdly imbricate reptile skin. And overall, he's riveting to look at, grotesque in that riveting way that flaunts its grotesquery. There are more cheap metal ashtrays and styrofoam cups in this broad hall than you'll see anywhere else ever on Earth. Gately sitting right up front in the first row, so close to the podium he can see the tailor's notch and the chairperson's outsized incisors. But he enjoys twisting around and watching everybody come in and mill around, shaking water off their outerwear, trying to find empty seats. Even on the night of the Interdependence Day holiday, the Providence cafeteria is packed by 2,000 hours. AA does not take holidays any more than the disease does. This is the big established Sunday PM meeting for AAs in Enfield
and Alston and Brighton.
Regulars come every week from Watertown and East Newton, too, often, unless they're out on commitments with their own groups. The Provident cafeteria walls, painted an indecisive green, are tonight bedecked with portable felt banners emblazoned with AA slogans in Cub Scoutish blue and gold. The slogans on them appear way too insipid even to mention what they are. For example, "One day at a time," for one. The effete Western-dressed guy concludes his opening exhortation, leads the opening moment of silence, reads the AA preamble, pulls a random name out of the crested Butte cowboy hat he's holding, makes a squinty show of reading it, says he'd like to call Advanced Basics first random speaker of the evening, and asks if his fellow group member, John L., is in the house here tonight. John L. gets up to the podium and says, "That is a question I did not use to be able to answer." This gets a laugh, and everybody's posture gets subtly more relaxed, because it's clear that John L. has some sober time in and isn't going to be one of those AA speakers who's so racked with self-conscious nerves he makes the empathetic audience nervous too. Everybody in the audience is aiming for total empathy with the speaker. That way they'll be able to receive the AA message he's here to carry. Empathy, in Boston AA, is called identification. Then John L. says his first name and what he is, and everybody calls hello. White Flag is one of the area AA meetings Ennett House requires its residents to attend. You have to be seen at a designated AA or NA meeting every single night of the week, or out you go, discharged. A house staff member has to accompany the residents when they go to the designated meetings so they can be officially seen there.
134.
The residents' house counselor suggests that they sit right up at the front of the hall where they can see the pores in the speaker's nose and try to identify instead of compare. Again, identify means empathize. Identifying, unless you've got a stake in comparing, isn't very hard to do here. Because if you sit up front and listen hard All the speaker's stories of decline and fall and surrender are basically alike, and like your own. Fun with the substance, then very gradually less fun, then significantly less fun because of like blackouts you suddenly come out of on the highway going 145 kilometers per hour with companions you do not know. Nights you awake from in unfamiliar bedding next to somebody who doesn't even resemble any known sort of mammal. 3-day blackouts you come out of and have to buy a newspaper to even know what town you're in. Yes, gradually less and less actual fun, but with some physical need for the substance now, instead of the former voluntary fun. Then at some point, suddenly, just very little fun at all, combined with terrible daily hand-trembling need, then dread, anxiety, irrational phobias, dim siren-like memories of fun, trouble with assorted authorities, knee-buckling headaches, mild seizures, and the litany of what Boston AA calls losses. Then come the day I lost my job to drinking. Concord's John L. has a huge hanging gut and just no ass at all, the way some big older guys' asses seem to get sucked into their body and reappear out front as gut. Gately, in sobriety, does nightly sit-ups out of fear this will all of a sudden happen to him as age 30 approaches. Gately is so huge no one sits behind him for several rows. John L. has the biggest bunch of keys Gately's ever seen. They're on one of those pull-outable wire janitor's keychains that clips to a belt loop, and the speaker jangles them absently, unaware, his one tip of the hat to public nerves. He's also wearing gray janitor's pants. "Lost my damn job," he says. "I mean to say I still knew where it was and whatnot. I just went in as usual one day, and there was some other fella doing it," which gets another laugh. Then, more losses, with the substance seeming like the only consolation against the pain of the mounting losses. And of course, you're in denial about it being the substance that's causing the very losses it's consoling you about. "The alcohol destroys slowly but thoroughly," is what a fella said to me the first night I come in up in Concord, and that fella ended up becoming my sponsor. Then less mild seizures. DTs during attempts to taper off too fast. Introduction to subjective bugs and rodents. Then one more binge and more formicative bugs. Then eventually a terrible acknowledgement that some line has been undeniably crossed. And, fist at the sky, as God is my witness vows to buckle down and lick this thing for good. To quit for all time. Then maybe a few white-knuckled days of initial success. Then a slip. Then more pledges, clock watching, baroque self-regulations, repeated slips back into the substance's relief after like 2 days abstinence, ghastly hangovers, head-flattening guilt and self-disgust, superstructures of additional self-regulations, for example, not before 0900 hours, not on a work night, only when the moon is waxing, only in the company of Swedes, which also fail. "When I was drunk, I wanted to get sober. And when I was sober, I wanted to get drunk," John L. says. "I lived that way for years. And I submit to you that that's not living. That's a fucking death in life." Then unbelievable psychic pain. A kind of peritonitis of the soul. Psychic agony. Fear of impending insanity. Why can't I quit if I so want to quit unless I'm insane? Appearances at hospital detoxes and rehabs, domestic strife, financial freefall, eventual domestic losses. "And then I lost my wife to drinking. I mean, I still knew where she was and whatnot. I just went in one day and there was some other fella doing it." At which there's not all that much laughter. Lots of pained nods. It's often the same all over in terms of domestic losses. Then vocational ultimatums, unemployability, financial ruin, pancreatitis, overwhelming guilt, bloody vomiting, cirrhotic neuralgia, incontinence, neuropathy, nephritis, black depressions, searing pain, with the substance affording increasingly brief periods of relief. Then, finally, no relief available anywhere at all. Finally, it's impossible to get high enough to freeze what you feel like being this way. And now, you hate the substance. Hate it. But you still find yourself unable to stop doing it, the substance. You find you finally want to stop more than anything on earth, and it's no fun doing it anymore, and you can't believe you ever liked doing it, but you still can't stop. It's like you're totally fucking bats. It's like there's two yous. And when you'd sell your own dear mum to stop and still you find can't stop, then the last layer of jolly, friendly mask comes off your old friend, the substance. It's midnight now, and all masks come off, and you all of a sudden see the substance as it really is. For the first time, you see the disease as it really is, really has been all this time. You look in the mirror at midnight and see what owns you, what's become what you are. A fucking living death. I tell you, it's not being near alive. By the end, I was undead, not alive. And I tell you, the idea of dying was nothing compared to the idea of living like that for another 5 or 10 years, and only then dying. With audience heads nodding in rows like a wind-swept meadow. Boy, can they ever identify. And then you're in serious trouble. Very serious trouble, and you know it, finally. Deadly serious trouble. Because this substance you thought was your one true friend, that you gave up all for gladly, that for so long gave you relief from the pain of the losses your love of that relief caused, your mother and lover and God and compadre, has finally removed its smiley face mask to reveal centerless eyes and a ravening maw and canines down to here. It's the face in the floor. The grinning, root-white face of your worst nightmares. And the face is your own face in the mirror now. It's you. The substance has devoured or replaced and become you. And the puke, drool, and substance-crusted t-shirt you've both worn for weeks now gets torn off, and you stand there looking, and in the root-white chest where your heart, given away to it, should be beating, in its exposed chest's center and centerless eyes, is just a lightless hole, more teeth, and a beckoning taloned hand dangling something irresistible. And now you see you've been had, screwed royal, stripped and fucked and tossed to the side like some stuffed toy to lie for all time in the posture you land in. You see now that it's your enemy and your worst personal nightmare, and the trouble it's gotten you into is undeniable, and you still can't stop. Doing the substance now is like attending black mass, but you still can't stop, even though the substance no longer gets you high. You are, as they say, finished. You cannot get drunk, and you cannot get sober. You cannot get high, and you cannot get straight. You are behind bars. You are in a cage and can see only bars in every direction. You are in the kind of a hell of a mess that either ends lives or turns them around. You are at a fork in the road that Boston AA calls your bottom. Though the term is misleading, because everybody here agrees it's more like someplace very high and unsupported. You're on the edge of something tall and leaning way out forward. If you listen for the similarities, all these speakers' substance careers seem to terminate at the same cliff's edge. You are now finished as a substance user. It's the jumping-off place. You now have two choices. You can either eliminate your own map for keeps. Blades are the best, or else pills. Or there's always quietly sucking off the exhaust pipe of your repossessable car in the bank-owned garage of your familyless home. something whimpery instead of banging. Better clean and quiet, and since your whole career has been one long futile flight from pain, painless. Though of the alcoholics and drug addicts who compose over 70% of a given year's suicides, some try to go out with a last great garish balaclavan gesture. One longtime member of the White Flag group is a prognathous lady named Louise B., who tried to take a map-eliminating drive off the old Hancock building downtown in BS 81, but got caught in the gust of a rising thermal only 6 flights off the roof and got blown cartwheeling back up and in through the smoked glass window of an arbitrage firm's suite on the 34th floor, ending up sprawled prone on a high-gloss conference table with only lacerations and a compound of the collarbone, and an experience of willed self-annihilation and external intervention that has left her rabidly Christian. Rabidly, as in foam. So that she's comparatively ignored and avoided, though her AA story, being just like everybody else's but more spectacular, has become Metro Boston AA myth. But so, when you get to this jumping-off place at the finish of your substance career, you can either take up the Luger or Blade and eliminate your own personal map. This can be at age 60 or 27 or 17. Or you can get out the very beginning of the Yellow Pages or Internet Psych Service file and make a blubbery 0200 phone call and admit to a gentle, grandparentish voice that you're in trouble, deadly serious trouble. And the voice will try to soothe you into hanging on until a couple hours go by, and two pleasantly earnest, weirdly calm guys in conservative attire appear, smiling at your door, sometime before dawn, and speak quietly to you for hours, and leave you not remembering anything from what they said except the sense that they used to be eerily like you, just where you are, utterly fucked. And but now, somehow, aren't anymore. Fucked like you. At least they didn't seem like they were. Unless the whole thing's some incredibly involved scam, this AA thing. And so, but anyway, you sit there on what's left of your furniture in the lavender dawn light and realize that by now you literally have no other choices besides trying this AA thing or else eliminating your map. So you spend the day killing every last bit of every substance you've got in one last joyless, bitter, farewell binge, and resolve the next day to go ahead and swallow your pride and maybe your common sense too, and try these meetings of this program that at best is probably just Unitarian happy horse shit, and at worst is a cover for some glazed and canny cult-type thing. Well, they'll keep you sober by making you spend 20 hours a day selling cellophane cones of artificial flowers on the median strips of heavy flow roads. And what defines this cliffish nexus of exactly 2 total choices, this miserable road fork Boston AA calls your bottom, is that at this point you feel like maybe selling flowers on median strips might not be so bad. Not compared to what you've got going, personally, at this juncture. And this, at root, is what unites Boston AA. It turns out this same resigned, miserable, brainwash and exploit me if that's what it takes type desperation has been the jumping-off place for just about every AA you meet, it emerges. Once you've actually gotten it up to stop darting in and out of the big meetings and start walking up with your wet hand out and trying to actually personally meet some Boston AAs. As the one particular tough old guy or lady you're always particularly scared of and drawn to says, nobody ever comes in because things were going really well and they just wanted to round out their PM social calendar. Everybody, but everybody comes in, dead-eyed and puke-white and with their face hanging down around their knees and with a well-thumbed firearm and ordnance mail-order catalog kept safe and available at home, map-wise, for when this last, desperate resort of hugs and cliches turns out to be just happy horseshit for you. You're not unique, they'll say. This initial hopelessness unites every soul in this broad, cold, salad-barred hall. They are all like Hindenburg survivors. Every meeting is a reunion, once you've been in for a while. And then the palsied newcomers who totter in, desperate and miserable enough to hang in and keep coming and start feebly to scratch beneath the unlikely insipid surface of the thing, Don Gately's found. Then get united by a second common experience. The shocking discovery that the thing actually does seem to work, does keep you substance-free. It's improbable and shocking. When Gately finally snapped to the fact, one day about 4 months into his Ennett House residency, that quite a few days seemed to have gone by without his playing with the usual idea of slipping over to Unit Number 7 and getting loaded in some non-uremic way the courts couldn't prove, that several days had gone without his even thinking of oral narcotics or a tightly rolled Dubois or a cold foamer on a hot day, when he realized that the various substances he didn't use to be able to go a day without absorbing hadn't even like occurred to him in almost a week, Gately hadn't felt so much grateful or joyful as just plain shocked. The idea that AA might actually somehow work unnerved him. He suspected some sort of trap, some new sort of trap. At this stage, he and the other Ennett residents, who were still there and starting to snap to the fact that AA might work, began to sit around together late at night, going batshit together because it seemed to be impossible to figure out just how AA worked. It did, yes, tentatively seem maybe actually to be working, but Gately couldn't for the life of him figure out how. Just sitting on hemorrhoid-hostile folding chairs every night, looking at nose pores and listening to cliches could work. Nobody's ever been able to figure AA out is another binding commonality. And the folks with serious time in AA are infuriating about questions starting with how. You ask the scary old guys how AA works and they smile their chilly smiles and say, just fine. It just works, is all. End of story. The newcomers who abandon common sense and resolve to hang in and keep coming and then find their cages all of a sudden open, mysteriously, after a while, share this sense of deep shock and possible trap. About newer Boston AAs with like 6 months clean, you can see this look of glazed suspicion instead of beatific glee, an expression like that of bug-eyed natives confronted suddenly with a Zippo lighter. And so this unites them, nervously, this tentative assemblage of possible glimmers of something like hope. This grudging move toward maybe acknowledging that this unromantic, unhip, cliched AA thing, so unlikely and unpromising, so much the inverse of what they'd come too much to love, might really be able to keep the lover's toothy maw at bay. The process is the neat reverse of what brought you down and in here. Substances start out being so magically great, so much the interior jigsaw's missing piece, that at the start you just know, deep in your gut, that they'll never let you down. You just know it. But they do. And then this goofy slapdash, anarchic system of low-rent gatherings and corny slogans and saccharine grins and hideous coffee is so lame, you just know there's no way it could ever possibly work except for the utterest morons. And then Gately seems to find out AA turns out to be the very loyal friend he thought he'd had and then lost when you came in. And so, you hang in and stay sober and straight, and out of sheer hand burned on hot stove terror, you heed the improbable sounding warnings not to stop pounding out the nightly meetings, even after the substance cravings have left, and you feel like you've got a grip on the thing at last and can now go it alone. You still don't try to go it alone. You heed the improbable warnings because by now you have no faith in your own sense of what's improbable and what isn't, since AA seems, improbably enough, to be working. And with no faith in your own senses, you're confused, flummoxed. And when people with AA time strongly advise you to keep coming, you nod robotically and keep coming. And you sweep floors and scrub out ashtrays and fill stained steel urns with hideous coffee, and you keep getting ritually down on your big knees every morning and night, asking for help from a sky that still seems a burnished shield against all who would ask aid of it. How can you pray to a God you believe only morons believe in still? But the old guys say it doesn't yet matter what you believe or don't believe. Just do it, they say. And like a shock-trained organism, without any kind of independent human will, you do exactly like you're told. You keep coming and coming nightly. And now you take pains not to get booted out of the squalid halfway house you'd at first tried so hard to get discharged from. You hang in and hang in, meeting after meeting, warm day after cold day. And not only does the urge to get high stay more or less away, but more general life quality type things, just as improbably promised at first when you'd come in, things seem to get progressively somehow better inside for a while, then worse, then even better, then for a while worse in a way that's still somehow better, realer. You feel weirdly unblinded, which is good, even though a lot of things you now see about yourself and how you've lived are horrible to have to see. And by this time, the whole thing is so improbable and unparsable that you're so flummoxed, you're convinced, you're maybe brain damaged still at this point from all the years of substances, and you figure you'd better hang in this Boston AA where older guys who seem to be less damaged, or at least less flummoxed by their damage, will tell you in terse, simple imperative clauses exactly what to do and where and when to do it, though never how or why. And at this point, you've started to have an almost classic sort of blind faith in the older guys, a blind faith in them born not of zealotry or even belief, but just of a chilled conviction that you have no faith whatsoever left in yourself. And now, if the older guys say jump, you ask them to hold their hand at the desired height, and now they've got you, and you're free.
135.
Another Advanced Basics group speaker, whose first name Gately loses in the crowd's big hello, but whose last initial is E, an even bigger guy than John L., a green card Irishman in a scally cap and Sinn Féin sweatshirt, with a belly like a swinging sack of meal and a thoroughly visible ass to back it up, is sharing his hopes experience by listing the gifts that have followed his decision to come in and put the plug in the jug and the cap on the phenermine hydrochloride bottle and stop driving long-haul truck routes in unbroken 96-hour metal-pedaled states of chemical psychosis.
136.
The rewards of his abstinence, he stresses, have been more than just spiritual. Only in Boston AA can you hear a 50-year-old immigrant wax lyrical about his first solid bowel movement in adult life.
There'd been a confirmed bull splatterer for years beyond counting. I'd been barred from fatalities at odd truck stops twixt her and Newark for years. Twill paper in the loo at home hung in these curled sheets from twill, I tell ya. But now, one day, I'll remember it always, to awake to the day after I stood up for me 90-day chip, and were 3 months sober, and were there on the throne at home, you know. Not to put too fine a point on it, I produced as her usual, and I were so amazed as to not believe in me ears. 'Twas a sound so wonder familiar, at first, I thought I'd dropped me wallet in the loo, don't you know. I thought I'd dropped me wallet in the loo, as good as me witness. So, down I been twixt my knees, and had a look into dem a loo, and couldn't believe me eyes. So, good people, I do then, I dropped to my knees by the loo and had a rail look. A lover's look, do you know? And friends, 'twere lovely past me poor powers to say. 'Twere a tard in Tulu, a rail tard, 'twere firm and tapered and ever so gently aged. To looked, constructed instead of sprayed.
To looked as I felt in me art, God himself meant a tard to look. My friends, this tard of mine practically had a pulse. I stayed down on my knees to tank me harper, which I choose to call me Harper Good, and I've been tanking me harper on my knees ever seen, morning and night time in a Toulouse well ever seen.
The man's red leather face radiant throughout. Gately and the other white flaggers fall about, laugh from the gut. A turd that practically had a pulse. An ode to a solid dump.
But the lightless eyes of certain palsied back row newcomers widen with a very private identification and possible hope, hardly daring to imagine. A certain message has been carried.
Gately's biggest asset as an Ennett House live-in staffer, besides the size thing, which is not to be discounted when order has to be maintained in a place where guys come in fresh from detox still in withdrawal, with their eyes rolling like palsied cattle, and an earring in their eyelid, and a tattoo that says, "Born to be unpleasant." Besides the fact that his upper arms are the size of cuts of beef you rarely see off hooks, his big plus is he has this ability to convey his own experience about at first hating AA to new house residents who hate AA and resent being forced to go and sit up in nose pore range and listen to such limply improbable cliched drivel night after night. Limp AA looks at first, and actually limp it sometimes really is, Gately tells the new residents. And he says no way he'd expect them to believe on just his say-so, that the thing'll work if they're miserable and desperate enough to hang in against common sense for a while. But he says he'll clue them in on a truly great thing about AA. They can't kick you out. You're in if you say you're in. Nobody can get kicked out, not for any reason. Which means you can say anything in here. Talk about solid turds all you want. The molecular integrity of shit is small potatoes. Gately says he defies the new Ennett House residents to try and shock the smiles off these Boston AA's faces. Can't be done, he says. These folks have literally heard it all. Enuresis, impotence, priapism, onanism, projectile incontinence, autocastration. Elaborate paranoid delusions, the grandiosest megalomania, communism, fringe birchism, national socialist Bundism, psychotic breaks, sodomy, bestiality, daughter diddling, exposures at every conceivable level of indecency. Coprophilia and phagia. 4-year white flagger Glenn Kay's personal chosen higher power is Satan, for fuck's sake. Granted, nobody in White Flag much likes Ken Kay, and the thing with the hooded cape and makeup and the candelabra he carries around draw some mutters, but Glenn Kay is a member for exactly as long as he cares to hang in. So say anything you want, Gately invites them. Go to the beginner meeting at 19:30 hours and raise your shaky mitt and tell the unlacquered truth. Free associate. Run with it. Gately this morning, just after required AM meditation, Gately was telling the tat-obsessed little new lawyer guy Ewell, with the hypertensive flush and little white beard, telling him how he, Gately, had perked up considerably at 30 days clean, when he found he could raise his big mitt in beginner meetings and say publicly just how much he hates this limp AA drivel about gratitude and humility and miracles.
And how he hates it and thinks it's horseshit, and hates the AAs and how they all seem like limp, smug, moronic, self-satisfied, shit-eating pricks with their lobotomized smiles and goopy sentiment, and how he wishes them all violent technicolor harm in the worst way. New Gately sitting there, spraying vitriol, wet-lipped and red-eared, trying to get kicked out, purposely trying to outrage the AAs into giving him the boot so he could quick march back to Ennett House and tell crippled Pat Monacian and his counselor Gene M. how he'd been given the boot at AA. How they'd pleaded for honest sharing of innermost feelings and, okay, he'd honestly shared his deepest feelings on the matter of them and the grinning hypocrites, had shaken their fists and told him to screw. And but so in the meetings, the poison would leap and spurt from him, and how but he found out all that these veteran white flaggers would do as a group when he, like, vocally wished them harm, was nod furiously in empathetic identification and shout with maddening cheer, "Keep coming!" And one or two flaggers with medium amounts of sober time would come up to him after the meeting and say how it was so good to hear him share, and holy mackerel could they ever identify with the deeply honest feelings he'd shared, and how he'd done them the service of giving them the gift of a real remember-when type experience, because they could now remember feeling just exactly the same way as Gately when they first came in. Only they confessed not then having the spine to honestly share it with the group. And so in a bizarre, improbable twist, they'd have Gately ending up standing there feeling like some sort of AA hero, a prodigy of vitriolic spine, both frustrated and elated. And before they bid him au revoir and told him to come back, they'd made sure to give him their phone numbers on the back of their little raffle tickets. Phone numbers Gately wouldn't dream of actually calling up. To say what, for Christ's sakes? Mud which he found he rather liked having in his wallet, just to carry around, just in case of who knew what. And then plus maybe one of these old Enfield native white flag guys with geologic amounts of sober time in AA, and a twisted, ruined old body, and clear, bright white eyes would hobble sideways like a crab slowly up to Gately after a meeting in which he'd spewed vitriol and reach way up to clap him on his big, sweaty shoulder and say, in their phimitic smoker's croak, that,
"Well, you at least seem like a ballsy little bastard, all full of piss and vinegar and whatnot. And that just maybe you'll be okay, Don G. Just maybe. Just keep coming. And if you care for a spot of advice from somebody who likely spilled more booze in his day than you've even consumed in yours,
you might try to just simply sit down at meetings and relax and take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth and shut the fuck up and just listen. For the first time perhaps in your life, really listen. And maybe you'll end up okay."
And they don't offer their phone numbers. Not the really old guys. Gately knows he'd have to eat his pride raw and actually request the numbers of the old, ruined, grim, calm long-timers in White Flag. The crocodiles, the less senior White Flaggers call them. Because the old twisted guys all tend to sit clustered together with hideous turd-like cigars in one corner of the Provident cafeteria, under a 16x20 framed glossy of crocodiles or alligators sunning themselves on some verdant riverbank somewhere. With the maybe joke legend, "Old Timer's Corner," somebody had majuscule across the bottom of the photo, and these old guys cluster together under it, rotating their green cigars in their misshapen fingers and discussing completely mysterious, long, sober matters out of the sides of their mouths. Gately sort of fears these old AA guys with their varicose noses and flannel shirts and white crew cuts and brown teeth and coolly amused looks of appraisal. Feels like a kind of low-rank tribal knucklehead in the presence of stone-faced chieftains who rule by some unspoken shamanistic fiat.
137.
And so, of course, he hates them, the crocodiles, for making him feel like he fears them. But oddly, he also ends up looking forward a little to sitting in the same big nursing home cafeteria with them and facing the same direction they face every Sunday. And a little later finds he even enjoys riding at 30 kilometers per hour tops in their perfectly maintained 25-year-old sedans when he starts going along on white flag commitments to other Boston AA groups. He eventually heeds a terse suggestion and starts going out and telling his grisly personal story publicly from the podium with other members of White Flag, the group he gave in and finally officially joined. This is what you do if you're new and have what's called the gift of desperation, and are willing to go to any excruciating lengths to stay straight. You officially join a group and put your name and sobriety date down on the group secretary's official roster, and you make it your business to start to get to know other members of the group on a personal basis, and you carry their numbers talismanically in your wallet. And, most important, you get active with your group, which here in Gately's Boston AA, active means not just sweeping the footprinty floor after the Lord's Prayer and making coffee and emptying ashtrays of Gasper butts and ghastly, spit-wet cigar ends, but also showing up regularly at specified PM times at the White Flag Group's regular haunt. The elite, the final E's, neons, ballasts out, diner, next to Steve's Donuts in Enfield Center. Showing up and pounding down tooth-loosening amounts of coffee, and then getting in well-maintained crocodilian sedans, whose suspension springs Gately's mass makes sag, and getting driven, wall-eyed with caffeine and cigar fumes and general public speaking angst, to like Lowell's Joy of Living group, or Charleston's Plug in the Jug group, or Bridgewater State Detox, or Concord Honor Farm with these guys. And except for one or two other pale, wall-eyed newcomers with the gift of utter desperation, it's mostly crocodiles with geologic sober time in these cars. It's mostly the guys that have stayed sober in White Flag for decades who still go on every single booked commitment. They go every time, dependable as death. Even when the Celtics are on spontaneous dis, they hit the old commitment trail. They remain rabidly active with their group. And the crocodiles in the car invite Gately to see the coincidence of long-term contented sobriety and rabidly tireless AA activity as not a coincidence at all. The backs of their necks are complexly creased. The crocodiles up front look into the rearview mirror and narrow their baggy, bright white eyes at Gately in the sagging back seat with the other new guys. And the crocodiles say they can't even begin to say how many new guys they've seen come in and then get sucked back out there. Come in to AA for a while and hang in and put together a little sober time and have things start to get better headwise and life quality wise. And after a while, the new guys get cocky. They decide they've gotten well and they get really busy at the new job sobriety's allowed them to get, or maybe they buy season Celtics tickets, or they rediscover pussy and start chasing pussy. These withered, gnarled, toothless, totally post-sexual old fuckers actually say pussy. But one way or another, these poor, cocky, clueless new bastards start gradually drifting away from rabid activity in the group, and then away from their group itself, and then, little by little, gradually drift away from any AA meetings at all, and then, without the protection of meetings or a group, in time, oh, there's always plenty of time, the disease is fiendishly patient, how in time they forget what it was like, the ones that have cockily drifted. They forget who and what they are. They forget about the disease. Until, like, one day, they're at, like, maybe a Celtics-Sixers game. And the good old Fleet First Interstate Center's hot. And they think, what could just one cold foamer hurt after all this sober time, now that they've gotten well? Just one cold one. What could it hurt? And after that one, it's like they'd never stopped if they've got the disease. And how in a month, or 6 months, or a year, they have to come back in, back to the Boston AA halls and their old group, tottering, DTing, with their faces hanging down around their knees all over again. Or maybe it's 5 or 10 years before they can get it up to get back in, beaten to shit again. Or else their system isn't ready for the recurred abuse again after some sober time, and they die out there. The crocodiles are always talking in hushed, numb-like tones about out there. Or else worse, maybe they kill somebody in a blackout and spend the rest of their lives in MCI Walpole drinking Raisin Jack, fermented in the seatless toilet, and trying to recall what they did to get in there, out there. Or else, worst of all, these cocky new guys drift back out there and have nothing sufficiently horrible to finish them happen at all. Just go back to drinking, 24/7, 365, to not living, behind bars, undead, back in the disease's cage all over again. The crocodiles talk about how they can't count the number of guys that have come in for a while and drifted away and gone back out there and died, or not gotten to die. They even point some of these guys out, gaunt, gray, spectral men, reeling on sidewalks with all that they own in a trash bag, as the white flaggers drive slowly by in their well-maintained cars. Old emphysemic Francis G. in particular likes to slow his LeSabre down at a corner in front of some jack-legged, loose-faced, homeless fuck who'd once been in AA and drifted cockily out, and roll down his window and yell, "Live it up!" Of course, the crocodiles dig at each other with their knobby elbows and guffaw and wheeze. They say when they tell Gately to either hang in AA and get rabidly active or else die in slime, of course, it's only a suggestion. They howl and choke and slap their knees at this. It's your classic in-type joke. There are, by ratified tradition, no musts in Boston AA. No doctrine or dogma or rules. They can't kick you out. You don't have to do what they say. Do exactly as you please, if you still trust what seems to please you. The crocodiles roar and wheeze and pound on the dash and bob in the front seat in abject AA mirth. Boston AA's take on itself is that it's a benign anarchy, that any order to the thing is a function of miracle. No regs, no musts, only love and support and the occasional humble suggestion born of shared experience. A non-authoritarian, dogma-free movement. Normally a gifted cynic, with a keen bullshit antenna, Gately needed over a year to pinpoint the ways in which he feels like Boston AA really is actually sub rosa dogmatic. You're not supposed to pick up any sort of altering substance, of course. That goes without saying. But the fellowship's official line is that if you do slip or drift or fuck up or forget and go out there for a night and absorb a substance and get all your disease's triggers pulled again, they want you to know they not only invite but urge you to come on back to meetings as quickly as possible. They're pretty sincere about this, since a lot of new people slip and slide a bit, total abstinence-wise, in the beginning. Nobody's supposed to judge you or snub you for slipping. Everybody's here to help. Everybody knows that the returning slippy has punished himself enough just being out there, and that it takes incredible desperation and humility to eat your pride and wobble back in and put the substance down again after you've fucked up the first time and the substance is calling to you all over again. There's the sort of sincere compassion about fucking up that empathy makes possible, although some of the AAs will nod smugly when they find out the slippy didn't take some of the basic suggestions. Even newcomers who can't even start to quit yet and show up with suspicious flask-sized bulges in their coat pockets and list progressively to starboard as the meeting progresses are urged to keep coming. Hang in, stay, as long as they're not too disruptive. Inebriates are discouraged from driving themselves home after the Lord's Prayer, but nobody's going to wrestle your keys away. Boston AA stresses the utter autonomy of the individual member. Please say and do whatever you wish. Of course, there are about a dozen basic suggestions.
138.
And of course, people who cockily decide they don't wish to abide by the basic suggestions are constantly going back out there and then wobbling back in with their faces around their knees and confessing from the podium that they didn't take the suggestions and have paid full price for their willful arrogance and have learned the hard way
But now they're back, by God, and this time they're going to follow the suggestions to the bloody letter. Just see if they don't. Gately sponsor, Francis, ferocious Francis G., the crocodile that Gately finally got up the juice to ask to be his sponsor, compares the totally optional basic suggestions in Boston AA to, say, for instance, if you're going to jump out of an airplane, they suggest you wear a parachute. But of course, you do what you want. Then he starts laughing until he's coughing so bad he has to sit down. The bitch of the thing is you have to want to. If you don't want to do as you're told, I mean, as it's suggested you do, it means that your own personal will is still in control. And Eugenio Martinez, over at Ennett House, never tires of pointing out that your personal will is the web your disease sits and spins in still. The will you call your own ceased to be yours as of who knows how many substance-drenched years ago. It's now shot through with the spidered fibrosis of your disease. His own experience's term for the disease is the spider.
139.
You have to starve the spider. You have to surrender your will. This is why most people will come in and hang in only after their own entangled will has just about killed them. You have to want to surrender your will to people who know how to starve the spider. You have to want to take the suggestions, want to abide by the traditions of anonymity, humility, surrender to the group conscience. If you don't obey, nobody will kick you out. They won't have to. You'll end up kicking yourself out if you steer by your own sick will. This is maybe why just about everybody in the White Flag group tries so hard to be so disgustingly humble, kind, helpful, tactful, cheerful, non-judgmental, tidy, energetic, sanguine, modest, generous, fair, orderly, patient, tolerant, attentive, truthful. It isn't like the group makes them do it. It's more like that the only people who end up able to hang for serious time in AA are the ones who willingly try to be these things. This is why, to the cynical newcomer or fresh Ennett House resident, serious AAs look like these weird combinations of Gandhi and Mr. Rogers, with tattoos and enlarged livers and no teeth, who used to beat wives and diddle daughters and now rhapsodize about their bowel movements. It's all optional. Do it or die. For instance, Gately puzzled for quite some time about why these AA meetings, where nobody kept order, seemed so orderly. No interrupting, fist cuffery, no heckled invectives, no poisonous gossip or beefs over the tray's last Oreo. Where was the hard-ass sergeant-at-arms who enforced these principles they guaranteed would save your ass? Pat Montesian and Eugenio Martinez and ferocious Francis the Crocodile wouldn't answer Gately's questions about where's the enforcement. They just all smiled coy smiles and said to keep coming, an apothegm Gately found just as trite as easy does it, live and let live. How do trite things get to be trite? Why is the truth usually not just but anti-interesting? Because every one of the seminal little mini-epiphanies you have in early AA is always polyesterishly banal, Gately admits to residents. He'll tell how, as a resident, right after that one Harvard Square industrial grunge post-punk, this guy whose name was Bernard but insisted on being called Plasmatron 7, right after old Plasmatron 7 drank 9 bottles of NyQuil on the men's upstairs head and pitched forward, face first, into his instant spuds at supper and got discharged on the spot and got firemen carried by Calvin Thrust right out to Commonwealth Avenue's Green Line T-stop, and Gately got moved up from the newest guy's 5-man room to take Plasmatron 7's old bunk in the less new guy's 3-man room,
Gately had an epiphanic AA-related nocturnal dream he'll be the first to admit was banally trite.
140.
In the dream, Gately, in row after row of totally average and non-unique U.S. citizens, are kneeling on their knees on polyester cushions in a crummy, low-rent church basement. The basement was your average low-rent church basement, except for this dream's church basement walls were of like this weird, thin, clean, clear glass. Everybody was kneeling on these cheap but comfortable cushions, and it was weird because nobody seemed to have any clear idea why they were all on their knees, and there was like no tier boss or sergeant-at-arms type figure around coercing them into kneeling, and yet there was this sense of some compelling unspoken reason why they were all kneeling. It was one of those dream things where it didn't make sense, but did. And but then some lady over to Gately's left got off her knees and all of a sudden stood up, just like to stretch. And the minute she stood up, she was all of a sudden yanked backward with terrible force and sucked out through one of the clear glass walls of the basement. And Gately had winced to get ready for the sound of serious glass, but the glass wall didn't shatter so much as just let the cartwheeling lady sort of melt right through and heeled back over where she'd melted through and she was gone. Her cushion, and then Gately notices a couple other polyester cushions in some of the rows here and there, were empty. And it was then, as he was looking around, that Gately, in his dream, looked slowly up overhead at the ceiling's exposed pipes, and could now, all of a sudden, see, rotating slow and silent through the basement, a meter above the different shaped and colored heads of the kneeling assembly, he could see a long, plain, hooked stick. Like the crook of a giant shepherd, like the hook that appears from stage left and drags bad acts out of tomato range, moving slowly above them in French curled circles, almost demurely, as if quietly scanning. And when a mild-faced guy in a cardigan happened to stand up and was hooked by the hooked stick and pulled ass over tea kettle out through the soundless glass membrane, Gately turned his big head as far as he could without leaving the cushion, and could see now, just outside the wall's clean pane, trolling with the big stick, an extraordinarily snappily dressed and authoritative figure manipulating the giant shepherd's crook with one hand and coolly examining the nails of his other hand from behind a mask that was simply the plain yellow smiley face circle that accompanied invitations to have a nice day. The figure was so impressive and trustworthy and casually self-assured as to be both soothing and compelling. The authoritative figure radiated good cheer and abundant charm and limitless patience. It manipulated the big stick in the coolly purposeful way of the sort of angler who you know isn't going to throw back anything he catches. The slow, silent stick with the hook he held was what kept them all kneeling below the baroque little circumferences of its movement overhead. One of Enid House's live-in staffers' rotating PM jobs is to be awake and on call in the front office all night for dream duty. People in early recovery from substances often get hit with real horror show dreams, or else traumatically seductive substance dreams, and sometimes trite but important epiphanic dreams. And the staffer on dream duty is required to be up doing paperwork or sit-ups or staring out the broad bay window in the front office downstairs, ready to make coffee and listen to the resident's dreams and offer the odd practical upbeat Boston AA-type insight into possible implications for the dreamer's progress and recovery. But Gately had no need to clomp downstairs for a staffer's feedback on this one, since it was so powerfully, tritely, obvious. It had come clear to Gately that Boston AA had the planet's most remorselessly hard-ass and efficient sergeant-at-arms. Gately lay there, overhanging all four sides of his bunk, his broad, square forehead beaded with revelation. Boston AA's sergeant-at-arms stood outside the orderly meeting halls in that much-invoked out there, where exciting clubs full of good cheer throbbed gaily below lit signs with neon bottles endlessly pouring. AA's patient enforcer was always and everywhere out there. It stood casually checking its cuticles in the astringent fluorescence of pharmacies that took 4